Welcome today to our interview series with outstanding professionals. I'm Stephen Ibaraki, and I'm conducting an exclusive interview with Ambassador Thomas Pickering, founding co-chair of the International Economic Alliance. And Thomas is an authority on international relations, government, innovation, business and investment, and policy. So, Tom, thank you so much for sharing your deep experiences with our audience.
Not at all, and thank you, Stephen, for the chance to do so.
Now, Tom, you've just got a remarkable career. I mean, just amazing. You know, you're in the top sort of elite echelon throughout the world and in history in many, many regards. Maybe you can maybe share, you know, one or two, maybe three of your career successes and lessons learned that you feel will be useful to the audience.
Sure. One of the most interesting things was when I was ambassador to the United Nations back in 1990 and 91, and Iraq invaded Kuwait. And for quite a time, we had to deal with the Iraqi problem in the U.S., in the U.N. Security Council, and we kept it in the forefront of the work. 12 resolutions were passed. That became the basis for decisions in the U.S. Congress and the involvement of the United States under President George H.W. Bush. And that was a particularly interesting and challenging time to be an American diplomat at the United Nations. Many years before, when I worked in Jordan, it was decided that the Jordanians, King Hussein, should have an air defense system, and we put all of that together. It took a year, negotiated all the contracts, and then over one weekend, it became apparent that there would be objections in the Congress, many of them stimulated by concerns that the system would be invidious to Israeli defense interests. Over a careful period of time, working very closely with King Hussein and his prime minister, we were able to solve that. At one point, we had to actually encourage the Jordanians to attack a particular U.S. initiative in order to find a way to let them get over the difficulty at home, while at the same time we did it with the Congress, a very unusual situation for an American diplomat, but an interesting one nevertheless. And so those are examples of the kinds of things that you end up in diplomacy. And one of those important principles is the ambassador on the spot usually knows pretty much how to solve a particular problem. Another is that sometimes more than half of your problem as an ambassador is with Washington, not with the country where you're residing. And another one of those is that particularly trying and difficult problems on a regional basis require a great deal of careful thought and preparation in order to get through the negotiating thicket, if I could call it that, and make things come out in a way that is mutually advantageous to all the parties. And in a number of my circumstances, we were lucky enough to achieve that. So those are all important things. I think that I would mention, if you're a diplomat, unlike what we're doing here tonight, Stephen, listening is probably something you should be doing two-thirds of the time, and unfortunately, I can't do that with you, but I try to practice that when I'm engaged with folks, because in many ways, what people have to say and what they want you to hear are often very, very important, but even more important is sometimes what they actually mean underneath all of that, and sometimes it isn't exactly what they say. And occasionally I found that they're not really sure what they mean until you have a chance to sit down and ask them a few questions.
I can see that all of that kind of listening and then finding common value points or negotiation points would be a key asset, especially in your current role. Now, can you describe then your journey leading to this role as a founding co-chair of this International Economic Alliance and how your roles, prior roles, I should say, played an integral part in this journey?
Well, I had a career that lasted over 40 years in the U.S. State Department. And the IEA issue came to the fore when I was in Russia. I had been ambassador in Russia for a number of months, and it became quite clear that a very interesting set of activities then being undergone at Harvard, which used the business school and its attractive faculty and indeed the Harvard reputation and a number of people in and around Harvard, plus some private folks who helped to inspire it, to respond to a Russian desire to be able to meet, work with, and develop business contacts that would eventually emerge through into investments in Russia was an interesting pattern. And so Harvard began to sponsor conferences. I went because I was ambassador to Russia. that quickly morphed into a situation in which it became clear that many other countries wanted to participate and saw great advantages. And, of course, the more countries we had, the more interested American leading corporate executives were, who were the other side of the equation, if I could put it that way. The IEA, the Harvard team in those days, was in the middle. It was so successful, in effect, that it hived off on its own. It has what is clearly a historical connection with Harvard, and a very, very useful way to bring to its meetings, which are held annually in New York at the time of the opening of the United Nations General Assembly, to bring to its meetings a number of key Harvard faculty members who constitute one area of interest to the countries involved as well as to the corporations who are involved. We are able to gather 200 to 300 people. We have 51 countries that have been involved very much in our work. And a number of these have resulted in what I would call ongoing tailored activities by the International Economic Alliance, working with a particular country like Malaysia or France on a particular trip of a very senior official of theirs, in which we, in fact, bring then our capabilities to gather around them American corporate executives particularly interested in that country and what it has to offer. And that marriage making is a very significant role that we play, and it's been a major feature of what we've been doing, and it's one of the things that I think has added from year to year in our interest, in the interest in our work and the growth and the number of people participating.
I guess with your background as an ambassador in international relations with the UN, you're a perfect pivotal figure, almost like a hub of an ecosystem to be a bridge to bring these different parties together. And then also your past term or working with Boeing at a very senior level, so you have this sort of industry connection as well and innovation, combining that. And I can see some of the value about that, about governments, corporations, and the financial sector getting involved. If you were to kind of sum it up, though, why should significant leaders get involved in this work at the International Economic Alliance when there's other venues such as the World Economic Forum or the Economic Forum in Astana?
Well, I've been to the World Economic Forum, and it's a great talk shop. You don't have the opportunities you have at the International Economic Alliance to sit down in a private room with a foreign head of state as a leading American corporate executive and talk directly one-on-one about what it is that you're interested in pursuing in that person's country and gauge and understand and receive commitments on the willingness of that country to open doors to work with you, to support your investment, to give you a clear-eyed idea of where that investment may put you in terms of expected return, which is clearly what you've got to do if you're going to keep your stockholders happy. So this is an enormously useful, targeted, specific set of activities that draws people back because they know and understand that we've had successes as we go along. A number of countries have moved ahead with the people that we've introduced them to, and that has helped to build and strengthen the obvious opportunity that many corporations see in what we're able to do. And we're able to build this in part because many of these leaders are coming to New York anyway for the opening of the UN General Assembly. So for them, it's an easy twofer, and we open the door to them, to many, many companies that they would not perhaps even think about attracting or be prepared in their own way to figure out a way to open the door. Many of them are located off on the other side of the globe, and so this compresses distances, sparks interest, exchanges information, details the communication, takes the individual entrepreneur and the country leader down the road toward success. And we stay with it all the way. We stay with it from the very beginning of the potential idea, right, till the investment is consummated. And then often we look around for the next set of things that we could work with them on. So it is a continued effort. And as I said a moment ago, we attempt to do things between our annual meetings, which are our major efforts, that will give countries confidence that we know these companies. We are able to bring them to the table. Particularly if it's a country where there is a growing specific interest in the opportunities to work there. And of course, we're the beneficiaries and indeed the exploiters, if you wanted to call it that, Stephen, of globalization. We're able to persuade manufacturers to invest. This gives the host country an interest in the product. That often means that we're more easily able to have the company market the product. In some ways, the product becomes part of their own national production of the country involved. They take a proprietary interest. This spirals upward into the development of new products, sometimes specifically for their markets. New opportunities to engage in local manufacturing, often that's been highly lucrative because, in fact, the costs are down. In many of these areas, labor costs are low. Electricity costs sometimes are pretty good. General ability of most countries to support and absorb manufacturing plants or service industries is growing all the time, and we try to take advantage of that. So this is a wonderful idea brought to fruition by the hard work of many people. And here I have to mention Van McCormick and his team. He has a wonderful team of student interns from a number of schools and colleges around Boston. And his connection with the Harvard Business School has all helped to promote what I would call the continuing very much appreciated efforts of the International Economic Alliance, which is a not-for-profit, and it is an alliance. It's built on the idea that as an alliance, it can bring together many organizations. They each can find their place in the sun. It doesn't seek to shadow anybody, and in fact, in some cases, it's prepared and fully interested in standing back and let some others enjoy the limelight.
I see. So I can see how you're clearly differentiated then from some of the other kind of forums that are out there, because you're very practically based, really focused on getting results and not just talk. And I that's good to hear. And I know that would be attractive to our audience.
Yeah. We feel that talk ought to be really the first step in practical action, but doesn't have to be a substitute for it.
Now, I guess my next question then would be about technology companies, and a lot of many of the people in my audience are executives in technology companies. Why should they engage further? Like, what are they missing? And can you give some examples why working internationally at the highest level is important to their bottom line and to their success?
Well, I think that there are several reasons. A lot of the places where we can help to introduce companies are brand new markets for them. So immediately, the bottom line is swelled by an opportunity to open and develop new markets. In many cases, they also will look for manufacturing or R&D or other kinds of research opportunities or cross-investment opportunities in these countries. And so on the manufacturing side, often you're able to take advantage of lower-cost manufacturing, not just for that company, for that country's markets, but often for other markets, so that there are real savings to be made. And that's one of the benefits of globalization, and we help our business clients and their friends to try to take advantage of these sorts of opportunities as rapidly as we can.
I guess it's also, you see some recent news items where Turkey, there's some challenges, I guess, between Turkey and Google or Turkey and Twitter and so on. Do you feel that your economic, your International Economic Alliance and your Global Investment Symposia, for example, would be a good forum to try to address or even prevent these kinds of standoffs that occur?
I think so. I think that a good start here often makes a serious difference. We try to work with countries and companies that have a clear record, where there haven't been the potential mishaps, where over time local governments may collude with local entrepreneurs to deprive a foreign investor of their investment. We think that there are ways, obviously, also to balance this. Sponsoring and supporting people who contract with their eyes open, who look at dispute settlement as a part of any contract, and it's fair, equitable, honest dispute settlement, often in places like London or Stockholm, which have been known internationally It was a very high reputation for fair judgments and a strong commitment to equity. All of those things, I think, are significant in the way in which we attempt to work with the two obvious sides, the visiting government people and the American business executive.
Now, you've got this remarkable history, and you've been a big part of that because of the tremendous success that you've had, and you've been able to bring that prior success and continuing success, for that matter, into ensuring that the IEA is really the organization to be part of in terms of the alliance, and also to be participating at their events. And so taking that as a bit of a background and your role in it and those of your colleagues and then working with people like Van, what do you hope to accomplish this year and how will you measure your success?
I think that this year we want to be able to move up from the 50 or so countries where we're involved and move up from the several hundred companies where we have been involved. We would like to see an even more successful series of events in mid-September 2014 than we've been able to have before. And that will be a challenge because we have now a number of heads of state and a number of other a larger number of senior economic executives coming to us. And so, to some extent, we have a challenge to fit them all in the day, if I could say that. But it's a format that lends itself to flexibility. And to private conversations and to taking the overall judgments which are provided by visiting senior foreign government leaders about their economy and where they're taking it and where they want to go, provide those to the business community, let them pick up on it. So I would say clearly we should be looking over the next 3 years at a doubling of our activity. Certainly, we would look at a one-third increase in 2014 as a very important goal, one that we could meet, but it will be a testing goal. And I think that's significant. People don't like to come for things that don't represent wide participation, enthusiasm, strong speakers, strong government participation, and strong corporate attendance. And so we're able, I think, to continue to provide that and to strengthen that as we go ahead. Those will be some of the hallmarks of our success. I think that those are all within what I would call the envelope of our core strength and activities. Moving beyond that, I mentioned to you earlier on several occasions the fact that we were able to organize separate trips during the year, which takes advantage of the fact that we operate 365 days, or whatever number of working days that translates into, rather than just purely for one event. Much of that is spent building for the one event, but some of that time as well is spent on working with individual client countries who are very anxious to have, a visit to Houston or Dallas or to Sacramento or to Madison, worked for them. By IEA with its contacts to bring people locally to hear what they have to say, to introduce them, and indeed to cultivate the conversations that often take place about what are your prospects in particular areas of business activity and what are the country's aspirations with respect to its own work in those areas or things that can support work in those areas. And those one-on-one meetings are absolutely invaluable.
I see. I can see how the events that you hold under the auspices of the International Economic Alliance is really a continuing story. It's a continuing sort of process of engagement and value delivery and exchange, which extends way beyond the individual events. And again, because of the leadership that you've shown, and then also Van and others, it's led to a very successful event. And as you indicated, your goals are to increase the participation of countries beyond the 50 or so that are participating now. So
I think, Stephen, you understand this very well. We're able to draw on people like Paul Volcker, Pete Peterson, Hank Greenberg, for participation, for advice, and for leadership from occasion to occasion. And that's been very valuable, and that's meant that the foreign government leaders have said, gee, look at those people. They're the kinds of people we would like to see engage with us as we seek further to expand foreign investment in our country.
Now, you know, to the audience then, what would be a typical event look like? You know, people show up, there's probably a networking function, there's what, open table sessions perhaps, there's some keynote speakers. You know, can you sort of describe a typical event?
I think that's right, and we rely on all of those techniques and more. Normally, we would offer several Harvard Business School notables. We would try to offer very senior American business leaders. I mentioned some of them to you just a moment ago, who would give their perspectives. We would bring in the head of state of two or three countries, maybe a prime minister or two, and they would bring a carefully crafted talk to, in effect, open the doors of the countries to the potential for U.S. company investment and hopefully open the eyes of American investors to the possibilities in that country. And most of the people we have come, since we're able to tell them in advance who is coming from the international world, will come because they're particularly interested in developing a business opportunity in a particular country. Often they have their own ideas already as to what they would like to go, but they can check them out. And so that takes them into the opportunity to go into a private side room. And what we provide in New York, and the Harvard Club has been our headquarters, which is in the very center of Midtown Manhattan, on a period of time when traveling has become horrendous because there may be 60 visiting heads of state in New York City at one time, and streets get closed and motorcades block traffic and things get very difficult. But we can put them in the Harvard Club with all the space they want and bring people to them rather than to force them to be touring around the city. So we like that framework, and many of them do too, and they'll come and spend hours with us, as well the companies. And so it is the private meetings that, in effect, gel the session as it goes ahead for the American companies. And that technique is a very good one. Open table conversations are very valuable, and they often provide kind of special introductions to American for American businessmen with key foreigners, and we attempt to get people in places. Yeah, the discussions and at tables where we know that their interests and aspirations are going to be, if not satisfied, at least provided for.
You know, Tom, you have a storied career. I mean, everybody knows of your career and the tremendous contributions you've made to your country and to the world. And yet it sounds like the International Economic Alliance is one of the crowning jewels in all the things that you've been doing.
Well, you're kind to say so. And my interest in this has been longstanding, beginning with Russia. But the people who make this go are the people who also give it 24/7 kind of attention and activities. And I mentioned earlier Van McCormick and his student recruits, his interns, some of the Harvard professors who work very closely with us. The long list and opportunities we have to contact that list of American firms and the growing number of partners. We have an Ambassadors Alliance in which we enlist ambassadors who are in New York at the UN, as well as those who are in Washington looking after their country's interests with respect to the United States. Sometimes we're out in the hinterland. Often there'll be consular representation of some of these countries out there that we can pick up with, too. And so it is a lot of people that make International Economic Alliance work. A number of us are pleased, obviously, to have been in on the early days and continued our work as supporters and advisors. I spend a fair amount of time in the lead up to our annual session speaking with ambassadors about their participation, what their interests are, who will be coming from their country, how can we best satisfy that visitor's needs?
Now, at the beginning at this of this interview, you talked about, you know, in your career as an ambassador or in the political arena, in essence, or government arena, how you were to address some international challenges through your elite diplomatic skills, and in fact, you're famous for that. And but are there things that continue to surprise you today in the work that you do?
Well, I think so. I think that this is a world full of surprises. Nobody has it totally taped. Everything from the economic downturn of 2008 and 2009 and its ramified effects, beginning as it did with what was clearly mishandling and misreporting of the household mortgage market in the United States, but it spread way beyond into critical issues of the future of the banking system, the survival of large companies in the United States and abroad, and indeed the survival of some of such economies as Greece and Portugal and so on, which were struggling to stay alive in the midst of these huge changes. Those are quite striking and important, and indeed hard to predict. It's often unpredictable factors for people in the business world, and I think we need to pay careful attention to those. There are political changes and upheavals that are going on. We're in the midst of several today. What to do about the future of peace in the Middle East, led by Secretary Kerry, how and in what way to deal with the Russian challenge in Ukraine, and how to stop it spreading further, and indeed, hopefully, find ways to reverse it, even if that's considered to be very, very hard, and how and what way we can play a cooperative role as well. There's nothing chiseled in stone that says that because we have bad relations with the country in one area, we have to have bad relations in every area as a matter of the fact of life or as a matter of some determinist activity that we have no control over. And so there are opportunities all around, even in the midst of sometimes the greatest difficulty, and those need to be seen, spotted, and we can do some of that, and developed, and in many ways exploited as time goes on. People are interested in our views on business conditions worldwide as well as political conditions worldwide, to the extent that those of us who follow that and can participate can share those. That's important as well.
I guess the interesting thing is that at the International Economic Alliance and the events that you hold and your sort of continuing processes that you have throughout the year, you can provide insights to those who participate that they can't gain anywhere else. And it's because it's directly from the source and it's unfiltered.
I think that's right, Stephen. I think that many of us who travel a lot, who watch things carefully, have the opportunity to consult a fairly large network of friends. Many of them intimately involved in decision-making overseas, and that allows us to bring to the table perhaps something that if you were not doing it in this broad and general way, people would be paying very large amounts of money to receive.
Now, I know that, you know, you've got corporations participating, governments through the, you know, the various leaders within the government organizations, and you have financial houses and so on participating at these events. Is there room for organizations and federations like other nonprofits? And let me give you an example. There's one called the Association for Computing Machinery. They are the premier scientific education innovation association. They are the largest. Actually, they're based out of New York. But there's other kinds of organizations in different areas. Is there a place for them in some way at an event like the ones held by the IEA?
I think there could and should be. I think that we would not want to have our International Economic Alliance meetings turned into a kind of money-raising session for particular non-governmental organizations. But if they felt they had something useful to contribute and showed that, then I think that would spin out naturally into where our work is going. I think that we can and often do have partners among our business friends in the business world. They are important to us because of their willingness to provide the financial support necessary to see something like IEA work. Similarly, countries who come to us are also, I think, as they see what we're able to do for them, convinced that economic support to us is important to their own longer-term future. And so there are relationships of that character that are developed and taking place.
Now, I know that, we see it in the news all the time. There's geopolitical and investment challenges worldwide. And are there areas that you want to point out that you think people should be aware of in the audience?
Yeah, I think there are places where there are opportunities, and they represent perhaps the bright spots and the attractive areas. I think that Northeast Asia in general is some place that people are continuing to look at. Korea, Japan, China, Hong Kong, Taiwan. I think that West Asia, the area of the ASEAN countries, which have developed a strong commitment to stability, to open markets, and to attraction of investment for economic development purposes, are important. I think South Asia is important, India, Pakistan, Bangladesh in particular. And then Africa is growing. Perhaps continentally speaking, one of the largest continuous long-term growth rates in history. And it would be a mistake, in my view, to underestimate that potential or somehow to minimize it, because it isn't on the daily front page of every newspaper around the globe. I think similarly, Latin America at a much higher stage of development, and with the growth over the last two decades in democracy in Latin America has opened up some opportunities as well. All areas are moving, but the ones I mentioned, I think, are worthy of particular importance.
Now, this is probably a sensitive area, Tom, to talk about, but, are there any areas of controversy in the areas that you work and your sort of your views on them?
Well, there are. I mean, the Middle East is full of them. And we have seen real change taking place in the Middle East with, at the moment, no yet clear result. And so that's, in some ways, put a damper on activity and development. And you don't want to walk away from that. That's all front page stuff. It's not something that is so totally confidential that bringing out of the closet would be shocking. Not at all. And so I think that there are obvious issues of that sort. I think in other places we can help identify some of the difficulties that one way or another might crop up. In Russia, a climate that varies now, it's perhaps more on the downside than an upside, and unless it's a very large market. I think in China, the obvious role of the government in almost every aspect of Chinese life, some of it now with a much lighter touch than it used to be, is important. In India, there are some places, and happily not all over the country, where there is insurgency, some places where government is weak and unable to provide security and support in a way that that an investor would want to have before making a decision to go in. So all around, there are these kind of local developments we have to be up to date with and follow, as well as the kind of general growth factors available in describing the country's economy and development progress.
Now, Tom, this question I'm going to give you, allow some flexibility, I guess, and the reason is it may be areas that you don't want to comment on or you feel that perhaps there's insufficient information or context that I'm providing. But so I'm going to just throw three topic areas and see if you want to provide commentary in any way. The three topic areas are the availability of free content on the Internet and your views in terms of IP and digital rights and so on. The second topic is on crowdfunding. In fact, last year in 2013, the World Bank came out a report on crowdfunding, this ability to fund companies and projects and movies and innovation by having masses of people make small investments. In fact, I guess in April 2012, There was the U.S. Jobs Act, which allowed for crowdfunding to occur. And in fact, I guess in April of this year, there will be something called Title III enacted, some of the policies associated with Title III, which means equity crowdfunding, where you can crowdfund from the masses and give up shares in companies. And I guess the third topic would be digital currencies. And you probably heard about the issues with Bitcoin that they had in Japan and then Canada and elsewhere. And you know, is this a reality? Where is it going to go? Do you feel you can comment in any one of those areas or not at all? That'll be fine.
Sure, no, I think I can. I think that with respect to open media, of course, this is a new driver. It's a regular source of valuable information. Sometimes you have to be careful, I would say, caveat emptor on some of it, because much of it is driven by interest one way or another, and of course much of it is loaded into a framework that's kept alive, and naturally it has to be kept alive by advertising, but advertising has its own influence, and people who are successful at advertising can make a great deal of money on the web, apparently, by moving in these directions, and that's significantly important. I think that the topics that you mentioned, including IPR, the failure to recognize and honor patent rights and copyrights and things of that sort, are failings that are fairly widespread. And as you know, the U.S. government, for a long period of time, has been urging its colleagues in foreign countries all around the world to straighten up and get right, join some of the international conventions, observe them, and do the things that make a lot of sense. The Bitcoin phenomenon is very interesting because it's a part an investment in a concept that has some value. It's almost a derivative. And at the same time, it is currency available to be spent in some limited areas at the present time. But there are people who, you know, bought for a quarter and woke up one day and found that it was worth $25. And there were similar arrangements. And there are some who bought for $25 and woke up and found it was worth a quarter. So one, you know, wants to be careful in one's Bitcoin investments, I suppose, to be sure, in fact, that they pay attention to the underlying value shifts as well as the flexibility of the medium to meet their needs for purchases. And obviously, I think, I suppose some people are invested in Bitcoin to be invested in Bitcoin rather than necessarily as a source of an alternative currency, but it plays both roles. And it's interesting. I frankly don't know where it's going to end up. It's fun to see and interesting to watch. I'm not putting any money in it. I'm not sure I'm ready to do that.
Now, as you look around in the U.S., and, you know, I see the U.S. is ranked maybe, 20th in innovation, something like that. It's dropped considerably over the years. Or I just saw in a recent report today where Singapore and I think Korea is leading the world in the ability of students to solve just sort of fairly complex problems. And again, a lot of the Western nations are lagging. And I guess that then speaks to policy. Do you see some policy changes that should occur, let's say, in the U.S. in the next 2 years? And then what would you like to see internationally?
Well, I think by their nature, small, wealthy city-states do better than large, ramified countries with vast populations and obviously a great deal of diversity. Secondly, for the United States, which has in fact stayed alive on its innovation and its encouragement of innovation, much of our most recent innovation has come through migration, and we need to pay attention to that. I think the third point I would make is that fundamentally we need to pay a great deal more of attention than we have been to primary, secondary, and higher education in the United States. We do a great job for a few, or for some. We do a pretty good job across the wide spectrum, but for large numbers of people, they're left behind. And I think we have to pull up the left behinds. We have to find better ways to seek out and train and inspire excellence among the broad middle. And we have to seek ways in particular to orient the very brightest people into areas where innovation gets widely rewarded and is part of our society. I think that innovation can be measured in many various ways. For me, for America, having worked for a large American aviation company, which has really been a combination of an engineering company and a superbly organized and managed business operation, staying at the top of the heap in innovation in all of the areas in which that company sought to manufacture winning products was absolutely essential. It didn't mean that we didn't rely on offshore manufacturing and indeed some offshore innovation to help us, but it meant also that as a major American company, we paid a great deal of attention to what I would call, if you look at innovation as a pyramid, the top two or three slices of that pyramid, and they were very significant and very important, and your ability to stay on top of those meant that somehow you could drive innovation down through the company as a whole. Innovation alone is not, in my view, necessarily the total measure of success. There are things like smart management, the adoption of lean manufacturing techniques, the ability to inspire and empower a workforce, the ability to generate from within almost organically new and superior ways of carrying out your business, whether it's in audit and finance to the manufacturing line or the tool support mechanism or the movement and use of contributing parts or the design process to assure that maintenance is superb and less costly than it has been in the past. These are all the challenges that are out there. They're exciting and interesting. People have talked about America losing its manufacturing capability, but I was happy to see the other day a new article saying maybe in the future America will once again lead in manufacturing, perhaps in narrow areas, but at a higher level of technology, and I'd certainly like to see that, but a number of things that I mentioned, I think, have to play a role in bringing that about.
I guess on the manufacturing side, you know, there is this tendency to outsource to an offshore to other countries because of the low labor rates, but the U.S. Is really the technologically the most advanced country in the world, and through the use of technology, they can actually produce and manufacture even at a lower cost than sort of lower labor rates in other countries. So maybe all of that manufacturing will come back to the U.S.
Well, I think so, Stephen. I think there's also the fact that we have one of the strongest and longest growths in employee efficiency. American labor and American workers and American managers in one way or another have seemed to kind of outstrip the rest of the world in their ability to produce more and do so more efficiently on a regular basis year in and year out over the last two or three decades.
Now, again, on the policy side, is there just one policy change you'd like to see? And don't just restrict it to, let's say, technology. It could be in anything, healthcare. It could be in, you know, better international relations or whatever. Is there one policy change you would like to see in the U.S.?
Well, I mean, I'd like to see a lot. But I would say, because I think education is such a vital resource for a country, that I'd like to see us continue to put and move education to the top of the list. We're recovering slowly in our competitive capacities to score on examinations. We produce some of the best and brightest in the world, but we have in measures against some of the wealthy and more effective smaller economies fallen behind for some of the reasons that I mentioned, but we have a huge wealth of human material in this country, and there is a great deal that more that I think we can do to give that human material the opportunity to develop, advance, and show its own growth.
I mean, I can see why you're concerned on the education side. I know I read some stats not too long ago where there was an indication that China graduates something like over a million people, engineers, in a year. I think South Korea graduates about 60,000, which is about the same number as the U.S. And a driver for any economy is all of the investment in education, ensuring that you have all of that throughput. So now we're down to our last two questions. You are this remarkable figure and with this just a storied history of many, many contributions which you're continuing to make. And as a result, you have traveled and you continue to travel, speak, and work. Is there any story that you want to share? Maybe something unexpected, surprising, amazing, or amusing?
Well, I thought about that from time to time. I can remember that working for Secretary Madeleine Albright a few years ago, I was in Africa and made a couple of stops on a dedicated Air Force plane, and I had to go that same day to Berlin to a meeting of the foreign ministers of the Group of Eight, which she could not attend, at least that evening, and participate in her stead at that particular set of meetings, including, obviously, putting in the U.S. contribution. We arrived at Berlin just shortly after dark and piled off the airplane, and a very old friend of mine was then ambassador in Germany, met me and took me in his car from the airport to the Reichstag building, where the German hosts were showing us the brand new then Reichstag building, and got out, and we looked a little bit at some of the old Soviet graffiti that was still left there, which the Germans had left, and walked up, and then I was on my own, and I began to feel a little uncomfortable. I didn't know what it was, and suddenly I saw that my shirt sleeves were well out of my coat. It looked like I was dressed in an Italian suit. And it turned out that the steward on the Air Force plane had given me somebody else's coat. Happily, I had my cell phone in my pocket, and this coat felt a slightly different texture than my suit, but it wasn't a terribly ill match, except that it just didn't fit. It was very badly sized, and I had an opportunity to kind of hike my elbows up into my sleeves, and the Russian foreign minister was a very old friend. I'd been there, and I took a nice stroll around the sloping ramp at the top of the building, and then we were called to walk several blocks, getting colder, to the Brandenburg Gate to have our picture taken, and I was able to hide behind the other foreign ministers. It was probably my appropriate place in protocol, and we climbed on a bus and went to a very nice palace. In the meantime, I got on my cell phone and wasn't able to contact the embassy in Berlin for some reason. The phone didn't work, but I could get my office in the United States. So I quickly told them what the problem was and said, you know, you got to find my coat, whoever it is. I'm happy to trade this one back, but I need it at this particular place by this particular time, because by then we're going to be on cameras and photos. Sitting around a table talking together, and sure enough, they were able to do that, even though I had to, obviously, for a while, practice sitting like an active cripple to get through the process of both looking like somebody should have been at the table as a diplomat while I accommodated this very strange coat that I had inherited from the airplane.
You know, that's a good story. It had me smiling throughout, and I'm sure you have a... I'm sure you have others that would just fill volumes because you've experienced so much.
Well, many. The truth is that I'd served a lot in Africa, and sometimes in Africa they serve you very strange things to eat. I can remember once in Russia, I went to Lake Baikal, and it was a long lake, and we sailed up overnight on a Russian boat and stopped at a beautiful island at which were large numbers of local people who were shamanist in their religion. One group of people in the region were Buddhists, and the other groups were shamanists, and was taken out to a place next to the island where a large rock stuck out of the water, and where the local shaman had prepared something. I don't know whether this was partly a joke or not, or partly something the shamans did to the Russians, but they gave you a glass full of the most bitter, potent liquid I've ever had, and custom was that the leading visitor, and I was the leading visitor at the time, the American ambassador in Russia, had to drink this glass down at one gulp. I managed to do it But I have to tell you, the whole evening was really badly spoiled. And the regurgitation, whatever it was, that the shaman gave me. So you got a lot of those kinds of treats as you went along around the world.
Yeah, and stories that, again, another great story. Now we're down to our last question, and this is where I turn the tables, Tom, and I'm saying, if you were conducting this interview, what one, two, or three questions would you have asked, and then what would be your answers?
Sure. Well, I think that it would be important for us to address the salient question, what's going to happen in the next 3 years in the world economy? I'm optimistic. I think there are going to be some places where it drags, but I think we're going to come back, and I think we're going to come back fairly strongly in about a pace a little more rapid than since we've come back in the last 5 years from 2008 to 2009. And so I'm quite optimistic about this. I see that coming ahead, and I'd like to see that move. I think that my question would be, where's the economy going? And my answer is the one I just gave you. I think a second question really might be, what are the crucial technologies that we should be paying attention to and that will help shape and move us in the days ahead? And I think that many of those are in the electronics area, many in the rare earths and special minerals. A number are in the small world of nanotechnology. And these three areas, I think, will see consistent and even more important growth. And I think we will see much use made of those. And then a particular problem in working in developing countries, particularly big ones, and I include China and Russia in that group, what are the kind of rules that you want to follow as a prudent investor? And one of those, obviously, is to know your partners. Another is to know the major levels of government with which you have to deal, central, provincial, and local. A third is to make sure you pay your taxes, that you pay honestly, that you stay out of the bribery and corruption business, because you'll be hit when you come back to the United States if you get involved in that kind of activity. And if that's the way you have to behave, then don't go there. I think that those are important questions that would all play a role. So I went from the, put it this way, the sublime maybe to the ridiculous, but across that spectrum of issues, those are some of the kinds of things that I think people will find interesting who are interested in the international economic alliance.
Well, Tom, those are great questions and answers that you've we finished our dialogue, our exchange, and I know your schedule is demanding, and I thank you for coming in today to share your deep experiences with our audience.
Thank you for your time, for your patience and your perseverance in asking those very, very valuable and interesting questions. And I hope that you will continue to find that this particular program, among your many others, will interest your audience and further contribute to those who I know follow closely your work and what you're doing. And I thank you again. I thank you for your very many kind remarks on my behalf, and I reciprocate them on yours, because I know something about what you have done to be a major player on the world scene as well.
Well, thank you again, Tom. And I want to close by saying I'm Stephen Ibaraki, and this concludes our exclusive interview with Ambassador Thomas Pickering, founding co-chair of the IEA, and the ambassador is an international relations, government, innovation, business, investment, and policy top authority.